I've said some really interesting things. I can't believe they didn't land.
Very questionable.
Yeah. You guys are really slipping that video content in on me. I don't get any approval process over that video content.
0%. Do I, Dennis? I will say this, Chris, if you don't want it out there, you probably shouldn't say it on the podcast because I'll put it on Instagram. I'll do it.
Really? So that's where we're at. We're at, it's called One More Hollywood Podcast, but there's no mores in charge. I get it. Okay. Fair enough.
There we go.
Hello, people. Welcome to One More Hollywood Podcast. I'm Chris Moore.
Hey, everyone. I'm Dennis.
And I'm Katie Marpey. Hello again from Sundance. When this episode comes out, it will be the last few days of the festival, I think. And we're going to be doing an episode next week where we talk about our experience there. But this week, we're going to talk about one of the purposes of film festivals that not everyone really knows about, which is that Sundance, in addition to being a place where people go to watch a lot of great movies, also serves as a marketplace for independent films to find distribution. However, film distribution has changed a lot over the past several years, especially with the evolution of streaming, and I feel very passionate about this. This is what I wrote my PhD dissertation about. So we will begin with chapter one. I will begin reading today. I'm just kidding. I won't. That comes later.
This turns into an audiobook.
Yeah.
I love it.
Chris and Dennis aren't here. It's just me reading. Just kidding. They're here. Please don't turn it off.
We're AI creations anyway. It's just Katie's podcast. And she created us just to give her someone to play off of.
Yes. Oh. I'm what computers think are good jokes. So that's great. Comedians great are safe idea. In the future.
I love this direction. So we're going to talk about distribution today. And I thought we should start. I mean, I would like to start with Chris, your experience of like film festivals and like how you've seen it change firsthand. I don't know if maybe we should like define distribution first in case people don't know.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
So I would say the kind of simple definition that I use is that the distribution part of the process is like the middleman between the production of the film and how the audience watches the film. So the distribution part of the process is like when the completed film is like placed in theaters and, you know, when it's going to be in theaters, how many screens, marketing and publicity are also part of that process. But it's also where all the money is. And I think that's the big factor is like it's historically one of the most powerful, you know, parts of the film industry.
And not having a distributor is what makes it an independent film, correct? Essentially?
I guess so. I was reading these articles that
it's
we did.
It's blurring a little bit, right? Like what independent film actually means.
I mean, I would have defined independent film as like it is produced without studio money. So it's produced independently of a major Hollywood studio. But often they also don't have distribution for that reason. But I do feel like, I mean,
but so like an A24 or a Neon movie in your mind is not independent.
Because they use studio money?
Because they used A24 and Neon's money.
Well, I would say A24 and Neon are like examples of independent companies. Okay, rather than like the big, well, this is hard because it, like all of these companies change. So like Netflix isn't a studio. They're a streaming platform, but I wouldn't consider films they produce to be independent.
Back in the day, the independent meant you made the movie without distribution.
Oh, okay. Let's go with that.
is what it really meant was you were taking the risk, the investors. Well, the reason I say it used to mean is because there are these quote-unquote independent distributors like A24 and Neon and Searchlight. You know, in my day, it was Miramax. And, you know, and those guys blurred the line because you already had distribution, but they wanted to make it at the budget level of an independent movie, right? Mm-hmm. And part of what independent means, and I try my best to keep my pessimism of the industry, but what it's really come down to is, can we make a movie where we can pay people less? Because if Netflix is making it, they got to pay them more, right? And and I think that's part why independent is so hard, because you don't really know. I had a weird experience as an example of why I think the business has changed and festivals have changed, which I think is somewhat of what your question was, Katie, is I went to see Poor Things in the theater by myself, and I loved it. I thought it was amazing, and it made me remember all the reasons why, you know, you should let filmmakers go do some crazy shit. It's not an everyday popcorn movie, but it is definitely well done, and I thought the performances were unbelievable. Anyway, but the point that was really weird was, as some of you know, have listened to the other podcast, we went through and picked the movies that we were going to get tickets to at Sundance. And in my mind, and this again is the old-fashioned mind, the movies that we were going to go watch at Sundance didn't have distribution yet. That's why they were going to Sundance, right?
Right.
Is to get distribution. But three of the movies that we all chose that we wanted to go see at Sundance had trailers on the movie before Poor Things, right? The Love's Lies Bleeding.
Yep. A24 already put the trailer out.
Right. So. And so the point is, I guess it was a long way of me saying that I think what's changed, Katie, is some of the films now at festivals are there purely for marketing, meaning they, you know, Steven Soderbergh's next movie is there. You're like, what, that guy needs more promotion of his movies?
Yeah. He's like sitting outside a building with like a cup and with some pencils asking
please,
for money.
Please pick up my movie. Oh, wait, my movie was paid for by Warner Brothers. It's
not. Yeah. Well, we should clarify, I think, that there are different sections of Sundance. So I think the ones where we are seeing movies that already have distributors is in the premiere section, which is exactly what you're saying, Chris. It's like they're just premiering at Sundance, probably for marketing purposes, which kind of goes back to that like cultural currency thing that we were talking about last week, where it's like it looks good to premiere at Sundance if you're an indie or you're marketing yourself as an indie film, even if you're producers.
Well, I have a question for you guys about that. Yeah. Katie, and I remember you had part of this in your thesis, because I've read the PhD and
thank you.
Thought it was pretty amazing, to be perfectly honest.
Thank you.
But one thing that I'm curious about that didn't get discussed that much because you were really looking at what streaming did. And one of the things festivals were meant to do, and one of the things that award shows are meant to do, and we've talked about that and will again, is to tell the audience, these are the good ones this year.
Yeah.
Right? To say, okay, maybe it's not an Oscar movie, but it's a Sundance movie, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not, you know, a super big action adventure, but it's a Hallmark movie and you're going to feel good if you watch it, right? Like we have these ways of telling the audience, and I know I've said this before, but the interesting thing about film festivals is that I've lost my ability to tell what it means to get picked. And particularly when you say, Katie, there's these different sections, like these premiere movies. Did Sundance actually watch the film committee of Sundance watch a bunch of movies and decide, we'll let this movie premiere here? Or did the distributor just pay them to have the premiere at Sundance? I don't know the answer, but it's a big difference for me. Right? Like if 10 neon movies were shown to the Sundance committee and they picked whichever one is a neon movie, or A24 and they picked Love Lives Bleeding, that would matter to me, because it's saying people know about movies, watch these movies, and decided you should watch these movies, whether you're buying a ticket at Sundance or whether you're, you know, going to go see it in your hometown. And to me, that's the interesting part about something like Sundance, is originally that's what it was set up for. This is the best of the movies that nobody is telling you about because they don't have marketing and distribution, but they're really good movies. And they usually have younger, newer talent. And they're usually about something that's a little less commercial than just straight whodunit or romance or whatever.
Right.
And Sundance and Toronto and the Cannes Film Festival in Europe and others had a real way of saying to the world, hey, somebody who knows more about movies than you has decided this is a movie you should see if you like these kind of movies, right? And that's why I'm fascinated to go, and that's why I was so surprised that the movies already had trailers, you know?
Yeah.
What was weird is they also didn't say chosen by Sundance, right? They didn't use Sundance in the trailer, whereas one of the movies that had a trailer did say, you know, official selection of Cannes and of, you know, these other ones. Not Sundance, but some of the others. So I was sort of thrown by, okay, it's definitely different. And then when you add the fact that they do episodic stuff now, right, it feels more like it's a giant party to try to get attention for all of these movies rather than really strict, we're trying to go find movies you would never have heard of and hopefully tell you about them.
Well, they still have the dramatic competition movies, which those are the ones that my understanding is they don't yet have distribution. So we are seeing quite a few of those also.
So Love's Live Bleeding can't win the dramatic competition?
I don't think so if it's a premiere. But I was going to say when you were explaining that, first of all, yes, I did work at Sundance, but I worked in the New Frontier division. I don't really know how like the programming works for the festival, the film programming, but I don't think it works like the programmers are watching the movies and putting them in a premieres category. Like, I don't think distributors are sending their movies that already have like distribution to the programmers. I'm thinking that maybe it's just as beneficial for Sundance. So to have certain movies premiering, so the American Society of Magical Negroes, I feel like is already getting a lot of hype, and maybe it is good for Sundance's publicity to have it premiering at Sundance a few months before it comes out. So then people want to come to Sundance and see it there or something like that.
It's an exclusive. We mention that word a lot on this.
Yeah.
Exclusive. It's an exclusive for Sundance.
Well, it's also theoretically an influencer group of people who go to Sundance to see the movie, who will then talk about it if it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And you in Sundance, you kind of have these like Sundance creators, you know? It's almost like they create this kind of Sundance club if you've gone through one of like the festival or one of the labs. So maybe they have like they're making an agreement with a distributor. Like, yes, we want to include this one as a premiere because there's cultural currency on both sides. We want to have these filmmakers as part of our club. But also, this looks good for you for marketing to premiere it there.
Well, and the audience, it's also good for the people who buy tickets at Sundance, right?
Yeah. Like,
well, I can watch one that's already been picked up that has big stars in it, like Kristen Stewart and the other people are Love Lives Bleeding.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey Wright. But the point is that's also, if you just go on to watch movies, why not see a couple movies that people already say are good, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And I think that's what ultimately they've become, I use the word party, maybe that's wrong, sort of celebrations and they have different uses, just like a, you know, a convention or when a retail outlet, you know, or a fashion designer has a pop-up store somewhere, right? And they're just like, hey, we got a bunch of people here who might like the clothes I design. Let's throw a store up, right? We got a film festival happening. Let's show our movie, right?
Yeah.
Like it makes sense to me. I'm not actually against it in any way. I just think they blur the lines a lot for the person who's actually trying to use Sundance, which I can't say how many people there are, to help figure out what movies they should see.
It is kind of interesting. I wanted to point out a quote from this year's Sundance director, Eugene Hernandez, that was in one of the articles that we found when we were doing research for this, who was talking about how a sales agent went to a distributor with the movies from Sundance, I don't know if it was last year, that didn't have any distribution. And they like said, we'll just give you these handful of movies if you can just like find theater space for these, you know, just put these in theaters basically for free. we'll just give you these movies if you could just put them in theaters. And the distributor said, no, we don't even want to spend the marketing money on this. Yeah. So it's interesting. I bring that up right now because if we're talking about the movies that are, you know, premiering at Sundance that have a lot of hype and marketing and stuff, but then there's also all of these movies that are featured at Sundance that don't have distributors that are just then just what happens to them. The distributor doesn't even want them, you know? So I guess that's the question of how it's changed.
In the beginning of streaming, that's what everybody said was going to be great, was all the movies that maybe weren't quite worth, you know, being on a, in a theater where you had to pay for a ticket, right, could find a home and then maybe find an audience. Now, I think what we all discovered was without marketing, without people telling other people, whether it's straight word of mouth or social media or advertising, or whatever, that something's good, nobody's banging around the Netflix menu looking for that movie. No one's ever said anything. So let's watch that, right?
Like,
So I think it's an interesting quote for him to put out there, because what he's saying is that maybe Sundance isn't as valuable as a marketing tool if you're really trying to make money from the box office. Maybe it could be a marketing tool, but you know, Sundance has tried a bunch of things and I give them a lot of credit. They've had Sundance Now, which was a channel. Yeah. They had a sort of self-distribution machine. I forget what that was called. Where if you didn't sell and get a distributor, you could distribute through Sundance and they would at least put it on their channel and do other stuff. But it's really hard because, as I'm just quoting sort of generically public numbers, unless one of you did the research on this, but usually it's 500 to 700 movies get made every year, right? And of those, you know, 80 get released in any kind of way that you would have heard of. So already the numbers are tough. It's not quite as tough as becoming an NBA player, but it's tough. And what they were hoping was if you had all these, you know, new streaming services which needed to fill their pipeline, that some of these movies would get found, which would help talent and it would help, you know, good stories that nobody ever saw. And it's, it hasn't 100% been that. It's gone the other way, where they're going for advertisers and they're trying to get as many people to watch and they need a certain amount, and that they, it seems as though some level of a theatrical release or even a broadcast screening of a show helps the streaming later, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's all these articles out now about how the NFL on Peacock just turned around Peacock, and you're sort of like, that's the inverse of Sundance. That's literally going to the number one piece of intellectual property, which is the NFL, and trying to get that to help your streamer. Not, we bought 20 movies from Sundance that we think are pretty good, and you should sign up for Peacock because you can watch them all for free, right? Yeah. Like, it's just, it's not having that
but
effect.
Are theaters that, like, I mean, I guess now, I'm just asking for now, say there are people who are looking to get distribution at Sundance this year. Is the, you know, a theater run, is that as exciting anymore as it used to be? I mean, obviously back in the day, that was the way you got things out. But now, since there's so many different ways, like again, you know, we talked about, you know, Netflix buying movies there and somehow calling them Netflix originals, even though they were already created, but without them. But the idea that these movies now essentially can become movies that you could just buy on Prime or rent on Prime, or, you know, there's different ways to get your content out there. You know what I mean? I mean, obviously, that I think is very telling, is distribution's now a wider pipeline. There's other options.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because as I was writing my dissertation about this, this was changing. So
you're typing it.
Yeah, as I was writing it, it was very kind of exciting and a lot of opportunity for independent film that streamers were buying a bunch of films at Sundance, even though it was really driving prices up, which we could talk about that too. So there were like caveats to the situation, but there was kind of like an optimism a little bit about it. And then as I was writing it, Netflix started to change their slate and say, we're going to focus on the bigger and better, and we're going to have the Avengers directors direct this movie with Ryan Gosling and Ryan whatever. And it just kind of completed the cycle of, okay, they started with independent films just to have some originals on their slate and kind of build up the platform, like, here's some exclusive stuff. And then once they got that traction, they were like, oh, actually, to drive people to us, let's get, you know, Chris Evans and Ryan Gosling and Avengers directors. So I wonder if it's still...
Well, but I think this is the biggest underlying problem of entertainment right now. And it may be true of... But when you get to these giant corporations, the numbers you have to hit for a thing to be considered successful are totally out of whack, right? Yeah. Like, to take a $10 million movie and say, look, we're only really going to distribute it if it's going to make $100 million, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the box office, everyone's loving, you know, Wonka, and everyone's loving, you know, $53 million, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the business has changed so much because just less people are buying tickets, right? And so they're trying to figure out the math. And I think what you just described, and I think correctly, and in your thesis, it's really good analysis of how that this fight between original content versus sort of big, or what's seen as big, you know, and then how much do you have to fill the pipeline, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what is it? And the truth of the matter is, the studios went through this probably 15 years ago, when they all had their own independent division, right? Paramount had a thing called Paramount Vantage, and Warner Brothers had a thing called, what was it called? Warner or something.
Classics?
Sony still has Sony Classics.
Sony Classics.
And, Fox had Searchlight, and Disney had Miramax. And what they thought was, we're the best at making these things. They just add titles to everything we sell. It's a different kind of movie, so we can have a relationship with talent, because, you know, the Chris Evans and the Ryan Goslings, whatever, don't always want to make Marvel movies. They like other things. And so you end up in this situation where, like, we can do both. And then what happened was, because it was a studio-based independent, quote-unquote independent, the budgets were so big that they wanted to make successful movies also. Right. Yeah. So the units all started competing against each other. And a lot of them became genre divisions. Right. So like Paramount, I think Paramount Vantage was the one that made the first Paranormal Activity. And it fit into their category because it was low budget, but it was as popcorn a movie as you could make. And I'm sure the Paramount, big Paramount guys were like, wait a minute. The fuck are you doing? Like, you're not supposed to make popcorn movies, right?
And how and dare you make money with that movie you just made?
That's the thing that I think is interesting, is there's this talent side, this mental side, where you sort of want to get paid full freight to do the movies that are clearly out there to make money, right? Like, and all of us agree, if you're going to do Deadpool 3, you know, Hugh Jackman and Ryan Gosling deserve to get paid, right? Because they're trying to entertain as many fucking people as
possible. Ryan Gosling?
I'm sorry. Ryan Reynolds. Yeah.
Gosling's not in every movie, Chris.
I just saw Deadpool 1 last night with my son, and literally, I still think it's one of the funniest movies I ever fucking seen.
It's cold.
It's so good.
So good.
Little hand. anyway, but the point is, that part you understand, right? So when Disney says we got to pay and you get to be in a Marvel, then there's the trade of, well, it might help your career if you do a Marvel movie. So they go get directors and they get people to do it for a little bit of a cheaper price because it's a giant piece of IP, right? But then you have all these other movies that, you know, back in the Good Will Hunting days for me, we used to always say, if you just make a good movie, you're going to be fine. Because the business will find the movie. They will sell the movie. They want to make money in the same way we want to make money. So we don't have to worry about all this shit. Just make a good movie, right? Today, I do think there's some good movies that get missed. I think there's people who might love some of the movies that they don't see. I think the streaming, you know, the separation of streamers so that you have to decide, am I going to really subscribe to all of them or not, you know, is something we've talked about before, but it makes it a lot harder for movies to sneak up on you and surprise people, which in my career, American Pie, Good Will Hunting, Manchester by the Sea, we snuck up on everybody. Nobody, you know, very few people are like, this is going to be a giant hit. They're like, we like this movie. If we can find an audience, this could be a giant hit, you know?
Well, this this is exactly what you said in my dissertation.
It is.
When I have a whole section about Manchester by the Sea where Chris was interviewed. And that's where you famously coined the hits to subscribers changing business model.
Yes. I'm not the only one now. There was a big article over the weekend by some columnist about how, hey, we all got to remember that at the end of the day, the entertainment business is a hits-driven business. And I was like, really? That's news today? That's a column? Like,
you said it first. I have that proof.
I don't even know if I did, but my point is, like, how anyone doesn't think hits still matter is craziness.
But do you,
right.
Do you feel like, because you just said Manchester by the Sea in the like list of hits, do you feel like you, even though it was distributed by Amazon, which was trying to get subscribers, do you feel like it also became a hit and kind of like surpassed? Like, how did you do both?
Well, again, and I'm grateful to Sundance. They gave us a great platform. I'm grateful to Kimberly Stewart because she financed the movie and agreed, mm-hmm. let's just make the movie and then show it to people. Because on paper, that movie's a tough sell. I don't know if anyone's seen it, but there's some.
Right.
I think there might be some dead children in it. There's some funerals. it's not the most uplifting. In fact, most of the conversation about the end was, we're not making the Hollywood ending. So, you know, we stuck to our guns, people. Yeah. but there's a reason why they call it the Hollywood ending. But my point is, it was seeing an audience with 1,000 people in a theater in Park City that made distributors realize, as you know, maybe sad as it is, whatever, it's moving people, it's touching people, and we could get people to go see it. It was also, quite honestly, a strategic plan on Amazon's part to try to get an Oscar nomination because no streamers had gotten a Best Picture. And we did. We got that for them. Again, I say we, really, Kenny Lonergan and Casey and Michelle and the actors deserve all the credit. I was just around. But the point is that they had ulterior motives. And Katie, you hit it really well in your thesis and also just now when you said they're now able to buy movies for things that aren't just to make money.
Uh-huh.
Like, I think if somebody actually did the full accounting of Manchester, which I hope they never do because then there'll never be any profits. But if they did the full accounting of it, the marketing money that was spent on that was much higher than you normally would spend on it because Amazon had the money and Amazon wanted it to get in the Oscars. And at that time, you had to be released theatrically to get in an Oscar. Now they're making that true again now. Mm-hmm. But I think that Manchester was the beneficiary of a whole lot of outside factors that we just happened to fit into at that moment at Sundance. Yeah. With Matt Damon and Casey Affleck and Michelle. It's just a great story to tell. And for Amazon to be able to say, look, we're not just making, you know, these little popcorn movies. We're trying to do these. Now, I'd argue they haven't had a lot more. You know, I don't know that there's a lot of Amazon movies in the nomination queue right now. But it was a successful use of the moment in time. I think somebody who wants to use Manchester as an example of making a movie today, I think it's even riskier. I don't know that there's a big deal. I think they've all realized that maybe getting an Oscar nomination isn't the greatest for getting more subscribers. You know what I mean? And I think it's really funny because I'm on Amazon a lot and they have, you know, and the way their menus are horizontal pieces, they have one that says Amazon Originals. And you got to scroll way over and then you hit Manchester, right?
Right.
And then I go on Manchester, and the stars on the actual people who watched it on the service aren't nearly as high. I think it's like 3.5 or something. That you realize that the everyday audience who's just looking for some piece of entertainment on Amazon, the last thing they want to watch is the sad movie about funerals.
Yeah, like, oh, that turned out to be really sad.
Right? Like, you're just sort of like, whoa. I'm not. I mean, and I got to say, I really like that about Poor Things, which is talking about some really serious issues and doing whatever. And there was a moment in my head where I was like, oh my God, they're going to have this ending. Please don't have this ending.
Oh my, I was the exact same way, because I like Yorgos Lanthimos, but his movies are always like, oh, this is kind of interesting and like a little disturbing, but like weird and creative. But then it ends and you're like, oh no.
Yeah.
You know? And so I was watching Poor Things, like, please don't end badly.
And I loved the ending.
It did. It had a good ending.
My daughter loved it, and the text I sent her after the movie was, I think we should get the general some water. I just think that's a really funny line. But the point is, like, it's different. It's such what you would quote-unquote call an independent movie, right? Mm-hmm. But he made it uplifting, right? I would argue he went with the Hollywood ending, right?
Yeah.
Now, I have no idea if he, in the script, didn't have that. I have no idea if while making it, they didn't have that. Because if you look at the scene, this is a real filmmaker thing, but if you look at that very last scene, mm-hmm. right, it could have been shot at any time. They could have shot it 2 days ago for all we know. Like,
right.
They were like, let's put in a happy ending because the other one sucks. But the point is, I think that's part of it is you want people to come away from the movie. At least I certainly did that movie, wanting to talk about it, enjoying it, being glad I gave him my 2.5 hours, like all that.
Yeah.
But I think that's the thing about independence is it's sort of like there's a few terms in Hollywood that are totally undefinable because people use them whenever they want. Independence one, producer mm-hmm. is one. You know, and sort of all that. And I think that this is a fascinating moment. And that's why I'm so excited to go to Sundance and be here and be talking to people and watching movies is because it's a place like Sundance where the people who may solve some of these problems are just going to be hanging around trying to figure it out. Right? It's not like they're having some summit that's put on by Allen and Co. where we all go to some resort and talk about what big corporations are doing. This is the real people who are trying to get movies made who are like, how do we get it back to where we can get some money back? Or mm-hmm. how do we convince the streamers that they should have a wing that is like Paramount Vantage or Miramax or whatever, that people can go there, right? And I just think I hope to be in some of those conversations just to learn, but also I hope that's what people are talking about. And that's a lot of what you talked about, Katie, in your thesis was this sort of what's going to happen to independent projects as these streamers and these big tech companies take over.
Yeah. You know? Well, I have some like numbers that were in my dissertation that kind of show how it's changed.
Yeah.
And it kind of relates to what we're talking about now. Like, so in 2016, when Manchester by the Sea was sold at Sundance, which I do believe we said the wrong year last time we were talking about this.
We did. I thought it was 2016. Somebody said 2017. So I was like, okay.
Well, it's just ironic because I got it wrong over and over again in my dissertation and I went back and changed them all. And it is 2016. So
was the Sundance. And then it came out at the end of that year.
Yeah.
And then was at the Oscars in 2017.
Yes. That's why we're confused.
Yep.
So anyway, 2016 was the first year that Netflix and Amazon attended Sundance, I think with the intention to buy movies. So previously, distributors who bought things at Sundance bought an average of 2 films per festival. I don't have this number, but I would say within a range of like maybe $2 to $10 million, you know, depending. I just feel like it wasn't the Little Miss Sunshine in 2006 was sold for $10 million and it was like a major bidding war and it was like outrageous that it was bought for $10 million. However, in 2016, Netflix and Amazon showed up and left with 7 to 10 movies each. And spent an average of like $10 million on. And now at this point, Apple, I think, has the highest record, which was buying Coda at the 2021 Sundance. So the problem is that even though that seems like it is creating more opportunities and more money for independent filmmakers, it's actually driving all of the prices up. at the festival, like in terms of the marketplace, so that independent distributors, independent theatrical distributors, the people who were like in the game before, can't afford to compete with like Apple and Amazon now, money.
If they just show up at Sundance with like a briefcase full of money handcuffed to their wrist, like there's no way that you could compete with that when you're trying to put them into small theaters and stuff like that. So
especially, I mean, I can imagine. Especially when they're not doing the math based on getting their money back.
Right.
Yeah, that's the other thing too. That's
like
the
Manchester, we had a bidding war between what today the vernacular would be traditional studios and Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. And the traditional studios argument was, we know how to do this. We know what's going on. We'll take care of your movie. We'll know whatever. But we can only offer you half of what Amazon's offering.
Yeah.
And that's the problem is, if they were like, we can offer you even 20% less, we might have gone with the traditional guy, right? Mm-hmm. Because we, that group of people, Kenny Lonergan, Matt, myself, Casey, we, and Kimberly, all love the traditional studios. We love those guys, and we wanted to support them, and we did think they would understand. But when it's half, right?
Yeah.
You're like,
yeah, that's a little different.
Look, we got investors. We got people we got to give money back to. Like, that's craziness. And you think in your head, do they have some genius who's banging out the data who's deciding that their double bid is going to make them money? And what you realize is, no. But it's the cultural capital thing you were talking about, Katie. For Amazon to have Manchester by the Sea had way more value than dollars, right? Mm-hmm. For this other company that's won 5 Oscars, that's released a bunch of movies that people love, they were doing just pure money. And they were like, there's no way anyone's going to make more money than this. So don't be crazy, right? And on top of that, they spent, Amazon, as I've said, spent a fair amount of money on marketing, which we're super grateful for.
I was just
going to
say, those numbers don't even include the marketing money, which Amazon spends a lot of money
on. And what
well.
People should understand is marketing money, you know, you've probably heard the term waterfall. And waterfall in the Hollywood business means as every dollar comes in, it falls down this waterfall where pieces of the dollar get taken by the people higher up in the waterfall. And depending on where you are in the waterfall, maybe one penny lands on your desk, whereas 85 pennies landed on somebody else's desk. So there's always fights about the waterfall. The thing about marketing and distribution and why those companies put up a lot, will put up money, is they're the first money out. So a lot of times you're in this situation where they're willing to say, you want to spend a lot of money and market it? Okay, just it comes out of your pocket, right? Like, we'll do it if we believe we can get our money back, right?
Yeah.
So like in Amazon's case, they're spending the money and they're saying, we'll get, now we were able to have a little bit of a ceiling on it, and they spent more than what was the ceiling, knowing they weren't going to get some of that money back because the movie started getting traction as an award winner, right? And so they can spend as much as they want. No one's going to tell them don't spend, but some of that money comes right back to them. So every, you know, they're getting every dollar until they get all their money back, right? Now, we made a little bit of money at, and with the money that they spent, there wasn't really a chance domestically to get any more, but we were able, it really helped all the marketing money they did for selling foreign, which the filmmakers and other people had a piece of.
Yeah, I'm kind of confused about that, even after writing 200 pages about this, but because they're all different. Like what are the trade-offs for selling your movie to a streamer for that much money? So like if it's Netflix, do they have all of the rights or?
Well, see, like Coda, which was, what did we just decide, was 2016 to 2021. So it's like 5 years later, right? Yes. Apple bought the world. They bought everything. So for the Coda filmmakers, that money, which I believe was like $17 million or something, was it. It was the only sale that any of the filmmakers were going to get a piece. That was their money. Right. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how much it cost to make it, but I'm sure it wasn't $17 million. And so they got that money, they divided it up, they spent it out, but that's it. They're done. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's part of the issue of streamers is they like to buy the world and they like to buy it forever. So you just get what they pay you, and that's why they pay so much. Now, we had enough leverage when we were making Manchester because of Stars and blah, 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 that they only bought domestic, which is North America, Amazon. So that's why we knew we're never going to get any more money from North America, because they've paid so much for those rights that it's never going to make a lot more than that. Right. Right. And then they they had this marketing ceiling and they spent all that money. So it was never going to, you know, hit. But foreign, we had a piece, and it was mostly, when this is the thing other people understand, is it was mostly Sony and Universal who bought the foreign. And so these big companies sometimes own the movies in different territories themselves. Right. So, you know, we got very lucky because we sold it while we were in production at the Cannes Film Festival with a big foreign sales company. Shout out to Nick Meyer and his team. And they were able to get a bunch of guarantees back, but we didn't take any money. And that's where, again, Kim Stewart deserves a lot of credit for, I mean, she doubled down. If we were at the roulette table, she'd put it all on red. And and we waited. And the way the foreign deals worked were based on how it did in the U.S. So once we made the big deal with Amazon, all the deals in these foreign countries went up. And so that's sort of the way it works. Today, any big sale you hear, if it's one of the big companies, Apple hasn't gone real international yet. So they don't have, like, people aren't streaming Apple in the UK, but Amazon and Netflix are trying to divide the world.
Right.
Right. They just want everybody to stream through them everywhere.
Yeah.
And they haven't quite got there. There's some countries that have strong streaming companies themselves, like India has a good one, Brazil has a good one, and so Americans are trying to get in there. You know, the UK is pretty much the channels, and they only have the rights for their shows and their movies in the UK, right? Like everywhere else, they'll sell it to Netflix or whatever. But it's a weird time, because that's what people are really buying, is the rights for a period of time. So if you're at Sundance and you have one of the movies people are trying to buy, you're going to be in a room wondering, do I sell it for 25 years to Amazon? Am I ever going to see another dollar? Do I need another dollar to pay my investors back? Do I need another dollar to pay the actors what they really should have been paid to do this movie? You know, that kind of thing. And Netflix and Amazon can walk in, and Apple, and give them way more money up front, but say, we're owning everything.
Right. We have worldwide in perpetuity, and
there's a couple famous stories where the big streamers had to actually give money back to foreign distributors because they wanted to buy their territory. So, like, a producer goes out, puts the movie together with guarantee from Germany and a guarantee from Japan and a guarantee from Australia, and then Amazon calls up and says, "We want to buy the world." Right. But these people have already put up $2 million each or whatever. Right. So now they have to negotiate with Amazon or whoever to say, well, we put in $2 million. We want $4 million. Right. That's, if you're not going to let us release it in our country. Right. Then we want double. Right. And in two of them, they paid it. They knew they were going to be so successful that the Amazons and the whatevers were like, nope, we'll pay you. And so you have this weird mini business. It's like that TV show where you flip houses, right? There's a weird mini business where you can flip movies, you know?
Interesting.
And so it's all a sort of market. And that's why our opening here, we were saying that part of what makes a festival like Sundance interesting is that it's also a marketplace.
Yeah.
Now, the difference is there's something called the American film market, which is purely a marketplace. It doesn't do any of the premieres and the celebrations and the, you know, acknowledging stars and whatever. It's just a marketplace. And you'll see a lot of action movies get sold there. You'll see the, you know, the what used to be the Bruce Willis movies and the, you know, stuff. But it is a marketplace of people who are trying to finance movies and then sell them for more than they made them for, right? And the streamers haven't quite figured out where they fit into that place, because they, you know, if you think about it from Apple's point of view, the $17 million or whatever they spent for Coda is still low budget for what they spent to make Monarch the TV show or one of those Tom Hanks movies, right? Like they got an Oscar winning movie for $17 million. If they tried to do that themselves, it would be a $55 million movie.
Yeah. Which is why, like, and I say this in my dissertation, it's like they were, independent films were kind of an easy target in the beginning because
absolutely
it, like, they're comparatively way cheaper and they're from a festival like Sundance that has been associated with quality and this kind of like cultural stamp on it. So it brings in a lot of benefits, making it a pretty easy target, which, I mean, my point in saying this is it's weird that like a streaming platform doesn't just make a deal with someone like Sundance and say, okay, we'll take up all the rest of these that don't get distribution and put a little like Sundance emblem and then a list of all the movies that were at Sundance. And
the Sundance bargain bin.
Yeah, it's like
Sundance Redbox, baby.
But I,
well,
I,
but
see
I
how
think,
that's...
Katie, part of it is they don't know what to do with all of those movies because it's what do they have, 85 movies at Sundance this year, right?
Like, yeah,
if they
like 80. Yeah.
If they were buying 80 a year, that'd be too much, right? But the other thing is a lot of the producers, people who have been in my position, wouldn't want that deal because they still believe there's a deal out there that they can get their money back, right?
Right.
Right.
And the point is, if you're Netflix and you just say everything that gets accepted by Sundance, we'll pay you the money back that you paid to make the movie, then Netflix might as well make all those movies. They might as well greenlight all those movies, right? Like, because now they're just guaranteeing the money. The other thing I was going to say that in that sort of area of the why don't they pick it up or what happens is you have a lot of different reasons why people invest in movies. Some of it is ego. I hate to say it, but some of these rich people just like having something to talk about at cocktail parties. You know, I used to joke with the people I work with when we were raising independent money, you know, don't ever ask anybody for more than their most expensive car cost. And luckily for me, there's like $300,000 cars out there that people are buying. But the point is, that's sort of how they look at it. I can buy another one of these Maybachs or I can invest in this movie. Right.
And then tell people I have a movie on Netflix available.
Right. Or well, that's the point I'm going to make, Dennis, is over time, what happened is Netflix, Amazon, Apple realized that there were projects that the egos of people overrode the money, which meant that, so like I have a number of friends over the last 4 or 5 years are producers, they've raised the money, they made say a $3-4 million movie, and they literally have one of these deals where it could go foreign, it'd be released on a really small thing in the US, it's all on the come, meaning if somehow people like it, he might get his money back, but no one's guaranteeing his money back. And then he literally has an offer from Netflix for $200,000, right? Which you would never say to yourself, because that's when Netflix realized at a certain level, right below, you know, the ones that win Sundance, they can pay anything they want because the people are desperate for their movie to get out, right? And what happened is it sounds a lot better in the golf club or at the country club or, you know, at wherever rich people go to hang out to say, hey, I invested in this movie and I sold it to Netflix, right? No, nobody's going to be like, did you get your money back? They're gonna be like, oh, that's awesome. What's it called? Right?
Right.
So my buddy, the one I'm thinking about right now, literally had to take the $200,000 and lose, right, $2.5 million just because his two biggest investors were like, we'd rather take the Netflix deal.
Yeah.
And the guy said to him directly, you will never see another dollar. And they're like, that's all right. We thought we could lose our money anyway, but at least it's on Netflix.
Yeah, I was going to say that earlier, Dennis, when you asked the question of like, are theaters still the kind of end goal or is that still the thing people are looking for?
Right.
I feel like when I was researching this, there was a brand name kind of currency to Netflix too. And I think the perception is that it's going to get more eyeballs with Netflix because everyone has Netflix. But also Netflix was kind of the original streaming brand name.
But it also means that your buddy who maybe wants to can watch the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Like, so like you could just say like
that
my
he
movie's
probably
on Netflix.
Has Netflix at home, type in the title and it'll come up. Right.
Like, right. Yeah. versus telling people to go to Santa Monica to a small theater that
right,
has
to the one
Lemley
screen.
Playing
theater.
In the yeah, Lemley you know? On Second
yeah,
Street.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, yeah, it's
for
just
a
on
week.
Netflix.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And this guy's probably in the oil business and he lives in Houston and it's never going to play there.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Like, exactly.
Which,
it's definitely on Netflix.
But that is like a good point about streaming. Like it yeah. does actually put more eyeballs on these little independent
movies.
But my
friend who's the producer can say to future investors of other movies, yes, I sold it to Netflix. But if anyone right. asks, he has to say I lost $2.5 million. Right.
Well, that's which, that's another
that,
example.
That,
of the,
that's
like,
a hard pitch.
That is know, but, that's a hard one.
But it's
that's
still
a real
the,
pro and
the,
con moment.
The cultural capital, you know. So
right,
it's like
right.
the cultural capital is I have a movie on Netflix. Just don't ask me about the actual financial capital.
Right.
But I have cultural capital. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure any of the people we're talking about. And again, I've been really mean to rich people. There are some great rich people out there. But in this moment, I would say the average rich person who invests in movies really doesn't understand cultural capital. It's
well,
so,
they can
it's
ask me.
Social capital for them.
Well,
right,
it is
yeah.
kind of the same. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like,
it's
well,
it's another
you know,
version.
I don't know.
At my,
I'm really
at my
glad
wine club,
for the
I need
world
something to talk about.
That poor right. things got made. Right. And
yeah.
that to me is cultural. I it's also fun when I tell people, you know, or somebody quotes back to me, how do you like them apples? Or
right.
this one time at Bandcamp. That's a different kind of cultural capital, but it's
yeah.
still both based on the quality of the project, right? When somebody's just like, I made a movie that got on Netflix, to me, they're missing what
for sure.
actual cultural capital is.
Right, well, right.
Going back to Poor Things, Sonia found another great article in Deadline, Indie Films Breakout Year, that talks about how independent film actually made a lot of money
yeah.
this year because we had the strikes and a lot of the blockbusters were pushed because the stars couldn't do promotion, and also the cape fatigue, superhero fatigue, as we predicted already.
That's right.
Here on One More Hollywood Podcast.
Yeah, this is episode 29. So if you're just getting to us now, feel free to go back and listen to the
yes.
other episodes because we saw the future.
We did. Yes. We predict everything before it comes out in the trades. But I just bring this up because it's going to be interesting to see what happens or what the vibe is at Sundance this year. I guess we should just admit we are recording, we're pre-recording this, so we are not there yet, even though I pretended like we were in the beginning. But it's just going to be interesting to see what the deals are that come out of the festival this year, if it's going to be more theatrical distributors or streamers, or if there are deals or there's no deals. I'm just interested to see, are people optimistic? Are they sad?
Well, the thing about that quote, and I do want to always thank Katie and Sonia for the research they do before we start recording, because it gives a lot of parameters for things that are actually happening and we're just not making it up as we go. And that quote, the one you just mentioned, Katie, was really surprising to me too. I mean, I think it's like
yeah.
$1.2 billion or something. That
yeah, Independence yeah. and mini majors saw $1.47 billion in box office receipts as of December 27th, up from $811.7 million. In 2022.
Right. So
big jump.
Theoretically,
big jump.
When we talk about what, you know, it's all about the money and people have to, you know, sort of pay attention, is that that kind of money, if you're making $5 million movies and you're just trying to get your $10 million out of the mm-hmm. pool, and the pool is $1.5 billion, you feel pretty good about
yeah.
maybe I can get my money,
yeah.
right? I think that that's what hopefully is going to spur that there will be this two businesses. There will be the Red Notice and the,
mm-hmm.
you know, the giant movies on Netflix, and there'll be the Indiana Jones, and there'll be Star Wars and whatever. But hopefully that 1 billion number stays where it is so that we'll all be fighting for it. And it's something an old partner of mine and I used to always fight about, because I was always say the money's there if you make a good movie. He would always say, nope, it's limited. And if you don't get in there and get your piece of the pie, you could miss out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a constant debate. So, but like you just said, it was almost $700 million difference between the 2 years.
Yeah.
Right? So I would argue that proves my side of the argument, but I have the advantage because I'm on the podcast and he's not. But the point is, anywhere between $800 million and $1.5 billion is enough to support a bunch of these projects getting made, right? Yeah. And so what I'm interested, if I'm in any business conversations at Sundance, is where they think or how they think that is going to get done. Is it going to stay totally independent, meaning it's like the A24s and the Neons and the and those people? Or are the Netflix and the other people going to say, we should release a couple movies into that because we might as well get our piece of the $1.4 billion, you know?
Yeah. Like,
so I don't know what will happen because they have more money to compete for the money. But it may just not be worth it, even if they're the best of the year, which makes $30 million. Right?
Yeah.
That doesn't matter to Netflix. You know, I remember at one point, one of the companies I was working at, Disney was thinking about buying, and I may have said this in one of the other many episodes of this podcast, but, and we got all the way to the end where we were like literally meeting with the head people about to sign our contracts. And the head guy sits down and says, okay, here's the only thing I need you to hear. Tell me is that if we give you the money to make 10 movies a year, 8 of them can make at least $100 million. And I was like, dude, in my entire career, I have 2 that made $100 million. Like,
yeah, you're going to make like, 8 a year you
think,
now. Holy
you you
hell.
Think
yeah.
we're going to hit 80% for 1 year? Like,
yeah.
I can't tell you that. I said, yeah. you know, 3 will break even. 3 will make a little bit of money or what they call singles or doubles. You have 4 left, of which 2 will be massive hits and 2 will be hits, mm-hmm. right? And that's what you got to build it on. 2 days later, done. Nope, not interested in this business. And I said, what happened to all the reasons you were interested in it 2 weeks ago? And he's like, it's a waste of money. If we can't make $800 million a year, it's not worth us as Disney putting our money into it. And again, this was before they bought Star Wars and yeah. you know, Marvel. And so I was like, he at least lived up to his point of view, yeah. which was,
I think they're doing okay.
I'm going to buy these things. I'm going to buy Fox.
What I believed to be guarantees, which we found out like, isn't accurate. But
I'm going to get the X-Men into my Marvel franchise. That sounds like a better investment than a bunch of independent movies.
I can make $100 million. But you're going to spend $300 million
right, exactly.
to get that 100. So I don't know if it's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is kind of how I ended my dissertation, which is why I'm like, I don't know if I'll ever publish this thing because it's just constantly changing and it's going to drive me crazy. But the way I concluded was we're at the kind of peak of this cycle of like, commercializing the process of distribution. So Netflix now is making these big movies again, and there's all another like big competition, high barrier to entry for independent films to compete. And but now, so I was arguing that this always ends with another wave of independent films. So this from somewhere, we don't know where yet, there's going to be another wave of independent films that break through in a different way. So this article was particularly interesting, and to see that, you know, they are kind of
the pendulum's gonna swing.
It's swinging.
Gonna go back.
Well, the irony is the $1.4 billion mm-hmm. is literally totally irrelevant to Amazon or Apple. Right? Like, mm-hmm. like literally, that's like a rounding error. So the question becomes, if we all who like and are maybe more making these original movies, quote unquote, independent movies, are all fighting for the 1.5, we may be better off if the big guys just decide this is their world. We're just not even going to get involved in that. Right? Mm-hmm. We're just going to let them do it. Occasionally, we might buy one at his festival. And that's why I think you're right. It's going to be interesting to see what sells and what doesn't sell. Because mm-hmm. I would argue the Coda purchase, which I think is still the biggest of Sundance history, is also a very commercial movie. Like, it's uplifting.
Yeah.
It's sweet. I think it's a really good movie. But it's not what you would picture as a Sundance winner. Right? And I think that's an interesting piece is is independent become low budget, you know, made by people you haven't heard of, starring people you haven't heard of? Or does independent mean things that are a little bit off the direct path of a Marvel movie, right? Like, and I personally think something like Winter's Bone is like that, right? Where they were like, this is a little different. There's no way Apple's making this movie, but we want to get it made. And they got it made. And there's a way to get our money back. And that's the big thing, is we need to reinvent the way we get our money back.
Yeah. I was going to bring up Winter's Bone, actually, because that was distributed by Roadside Attractions, where I used to work. And I remember the story when I was working there, because it was right after they distributed Winter's Bone. And Dusty, who was in charge of acquisitions, just saw it at Sundance, I believe, and was like, that was really good. No one's interested in this movie. And he brought it to the presidents of Roadside Attractions, like, you have to see this movie. They also loved it and they bought it. It was just this little movie that no one else was really interested in distributing
at
Sundance.
She hadn't done Hunger
Games
yet.
She hadn't done anything yet. So no, now that was her first, we had like a joke within Roadside at the time that Dusty like found Jennifer Lawrence and launched her career, you know?
Well, she was on a TBS TV series called The Big and the Bill or Bob Engvall Show.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
She was the daughter.
Never mind.
Sorry, wasn't familiar.
That nomination that came after that
TBS comedies?
I'll look it up. Thanks. So, I mean, that's an example of something that can come out of Sundance that is, Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah, but that's the great thing about when I say we just have to refigure it out is because Dusty, his bosses, mm-hmm. and then the world at large, there was a roadmap that they've been using for years to make the money back, to push the movie. It helped Jennifer's career. The movie is known, all that, right?
Yeah.
And some of those, that road has had a couple washouts. There's a couple places where it no longer is a straight road to, if you just have a good movie, you'll be able to get your money back or maybe make a little, right? And I think that's the saddest part, is if I were at one of these streamers, it's just one of these things where I would say, we should just patch up that road. We don't have to take it over. It doesn't have to be a road that goes directly to Netflix, right? You could just say the business is better if that road for Roadside Attractions to find Winter's Bone and put it out there for people to watch is starting to crumble because people, and I think it is personally, what we need is to patch it up, right? Because it's not hurting them. That $1 billion wouldn't go to the next Ryan Reynolds movie on Netflix anyway. Those people are going to find something else to spend the $1 billion on that isn't going to be Taylor Swift Eras Tour. I had to get her in there, Katie, just for you.
Yeah, thank you.
But my point is, if I was them, I would just say, look, let's just make sure it works, and we'll have, maybe it's not, we'll guarantee we release all of them, but if you don't sell and you don't do whatever, we have this path, right? And Netflix will throw it on, or the Neons, or some of the theaters, like, you know, Dennis and I went to, the Alamo Drafthouse, which I still think is a good example of where you feel like they love movies and you feel like you go there and see movies, and maybe somebody gives them some money and says, you know what, just keep this thing going.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, this is kind of what you're saying, but I think to continue the metaphor, rather than patching up that path, what will need to happen is that like someone just like carves out a new path, because I think that's what happened. It's almost the exact same thing happens over and over, but just with a different path, like a different like means to getting the movie to the audience. So you could also argue that something like Little Miss Sunshine or The Spectacular Now were just as kind of commercial as Coda, you know?
Yeah.
So these kind of big movies come out of Sundance and they either go to, like, they just go to the part of the industry that has kind of commodified this correctly for the time. So I think even Roadside Attractions, even, they started when the studio indie divisions were, you know, ruling everything. They started Day and Date, which was like putting it on a video on demand platform the same day that it came out in theaters to make a little bit of extra money. So that was like them carving a new path that incorporated digital distribution. But then that all got commodified by streaming. So now basically one more Hollywood distribution just needs to find a new way of distributing independent films. That's my argument.
Oh, I like it.
What I would say is the interesting piece that I really think we should all look at, and I'll make us talk about in one of the post Sundance podcasts, will be about if we found sort of a way that seemed to be working for people, right? Yeah. Like while we were there, was it word of mouth? Was it authentic? You know, I'm a believer that it's going to be sort of smaller channels that are authentic, that aren't part of these giant corporations, where audience can say, like playlists on Spotify, right?
Yeah.
Or like, you know, the sections that people have, or our new favorite partner who hasn't paid us a dollar, but we still like what they're doing, is Letterboxd, right? Where people go on Letterboxd and they find it and they see what other people are hitting and they're talking about other stuff. And, you know, and it's that sort of way of people sharing, and then some people will become quote unquote influencers and will have people actually follow them, you know? And I was saying one of the things we should try to do at some point is see if we fall in love with a movie, say we all fall in love with a movie at Sundance, we try to convince people to go see it faster than they normally would have, or to go see it in theaters, because that's a way to say to the business, hey, keep making these kind of movies. Right. And if everyone is just sort of waiting around and it's very disparate, it becomes harder to argue to get the money. Right. And the problem with filmed entertainment is no matter what, it will be more expensive than other forms of content. You know, it'll never be as cheap as writing a book. It'll never be as cheap as recording a song. It'll never be as cheap as putting on a play. So you have to always think about the number's a little bit higher. And I know I'm sure if we have anyone listening from those companies that make $5,000 movies, okay, come back at us. But I would argue the $5,000 movie is its own thing. It's not what we're talking about. But anyway, I just think you're right. If it, you know, one more Hollywood distribution makes me laugh, but I don't really think I should be picking all the movies for people.
I'll do it.
And yeah, Katie. But the point is, Katie, you'll find your people, and then that'll have a ceiling, not because you're not awesome and super smart, but because your taste will appeal to certain group people, right?
Right.
Dennis will have his, and his will appeal to certain group people, and theoretically I'd have some of mine. And together, it might be a big enough group that if we have our letterbox section or our own stuff on our website or whatever, and people start listening, that'd be great, right? But I don't know what it's going to be, because for me, and this is just me as, again, maybe older, been in it for a little while, companies don't carry that anymore for me. There's not a company that could say, I picked up this movie and that would mean, oh, I have to see it.
Not even like A24?
No. I've seen a bunch of A24 movies where I was like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. I can tell you, for my college students, A24 is a brand. Like, they will
Even
an
Neon,
A24 movie.
I see that sign in the front and I go, okay, all right, all right.
Should we wrap this up?
Yes, I think we should. So I would say for anybody who, you know, even just searching what independent films, like, you know, best independent films on Google, you'll be surprised by a lot of independent movies that you didn't know were independents that you love, that you truly enjoy. So please watch some independent films. Look out for some new future independent films. Hopefully we'll find some really good stuff at Sundance so we can report it in next week's episode. What is your favorite indie film? We want to hear from you. Check out our Instagram, follow our podcast, and tune in every Thursday for a new episode. Thanks for listening, everyone.